So in the story of Ruth, we're familiar. Let's recap. Ruth and Naomi have a problem. Naomi is the matriarch. She was married, but there was famine in the land where her husband was from, so they moved. They wandered several hundred miles in one direction looking for food and then became established. They stayed, they settled, bore two sons. They had two sons together. The sons grew up. The sons got married to two women named Ruth and Orpah. And then, all of a sudden, one day, Naomi's husband died. And shortly thereafter, both of her adult sons died. And so you have three women out in the middle of nowhere with no way to sustain themselves, because at that point, women couldn't work outside the home. And they didn't have security of having a man present, which meant that there was a physical safety issue. And they didn't know what to do. Naomi urged the two women to go back to their homes, her daughters-in-law to go back to their mother's homes, to find shelter, safety, and sustenance, knowing that she couldn't support all three of them, let alone herself. So she urges them to go. Orpah says, okay, I'll go, kisses her goodbye, and goes home. Ruth decides to stay. She decides to throw in her lot with Naomi. And Naomi says, I'm going to head back to the land where my husband was from and see if I can find somebody there that will help me. And so they journey back. So they have several problems. They have a safety and security problem. They need shelter. They need some sort of permanent shelter. In order to do this, they need some sort of land to live on. Those are long-term problems that need to be addressed. The immediate short-term problem is they have to eat every day. And so this presents a problem because they don't have an income. They don't have jobs. They can't just go, you know, to the local unemployment office and get a little minimum wage job to tide themselves over. They don't have very many options at all. So I was really surprised ages ago when I was working in affordable housing. I was helping develop affordable housing, and I was putting together resident services package for the properties that we're building. And during that process, I did a lot of research on food supplements and food stamps and the history of welfare and such. And I was really surprised to discover the history of it because it's closely tied to education. Few people know this. I didn't know it till I read about it. So back in the day, Depression era, when everybody was struggling, there were a lot of migrant farm workers that were working through the Dust Belt. They discovered that there was a very big gap between children in elementary school and middle school who were from affluent families and children who were not. There were behavior problems. They kept falling asleep in class. They were struggling and failing academically. And they couldn't figure out what was the cause. And there was a lot of stigma around this, a lot of guessing. You know, people assumed, well, if they're poor, maybe their parents aren't that smart, right? They assumed maybe, and we hear this, we don't hear it said explicitly, but it is out there. Well, maybe people who don't have as much money just don't care about their children as much, and so they're not as invested in their education. How many people have heard this or something like it? Yeah, a few people. Yeah, it's all hogwash. So they decided to try something. Because the kids that were not from the affluent families, often they were from the families that were traveling around with the crops, right? Very much like Ruth and Naomi do as they go back to the hometown during the barley harvest, and which then fades into the wheat harvest, which then moves into the next harvest. And so these kids were often living in like shacks, dirt floor shacks with no indoor plumbing and no electricity. And what the government decided to do is they decided to pilot a program to give these people these little pieces of paper that allowed them to go to any grocery store and they could cash them in for food. It was the original food stamps, if you will. It was a little pilot program. They decided to try it for a year and just see what would happen. And so they distributed these around and then checked back in with the kids a year later. And what they discovered was amazing. The kids, even though they were still living in a shack with a dirt floor, no indoor plumbing, and no electricity, were succeeding in school on par with the kids that were from affluent families. Just having basic nutrition 3 times a day made the difference. And their behavior problems disappeared, falling asleep in class disappeared, and they were performing right on par in all of their academic work and in their tests, just from having food. And so then they rolled out a federal food stamp program, and we've seen that be whittled away at over the years. So, when I was a kid, my mother was raising me and my two brothers, by herself. My dad had disappeared, abandoned the family when I was about 5. A few of you know that about me, but that is the fact. And so she was trying to raise all 3 of us on her own. And she was working a job, I don't know if it was minimum wage, but it was pretty close to it. And I remember learning years later, she said at one point she was doing so well in her job, they wanted to offer her a raise. They wanted to give her a 15 cents an hour raise. Now, how many people remember when 15 cents an hour raise was a really big deal? I remember when I went from 415 to 450, and I thought like I had won the lottery. And she couldn't take the raise, because if she had taken the raise, she would have lost the federally subsidized childcare that she had. She would have lost the school lunch program that allowed us all to eat a nutritious lunch every single day. And it would have put her in a slightly different tax bracket, which would have meant that she would have had to pay a huge amount more of taxes. She couldn't take any raise until about 5 or 6 years later, when she was able to triple her salary after she finished her education. That was the only thing that could justify losing all of the benefits that she had. Does that make sense? The other thing that I remember from that time period was I remember dinner time at our house. My mother always cooked everything from scratch. Everything from scratch. And I remember, you know, we would be having something for dinner, pork chops and vegetables and potatoes or whatever, and there would always be a loaf of bread on the table. You know, do you remember when bread was like 59 cents a loaf, 39 cents a loaf? And it was like, I mean, there were loaves of bread, and there was Wonder Bread, and then there was the loaves that were like the 39 cents a loaf bread, where if you try to put butter on it, it would just fall apart. You know what I'm talking about? Like, you toast it, and that butter better be really soft, because that bread was the lousiest, most garbage bread you could possibly eat. And that loaf of bread was always on the table. And my mother would always say, here, have a piece of bread with dinner. Have a piece of bread with dinner. Put some butter and have some piece of bread with dinner. Well, now, I would eat it with a sandwich, maybe. And if forced to, I would have a piece of toast. But I didn't like to eat it just to eat it. I didn't like the taste. And I was just horrified. I never said anything, but I was horrified that my mother would gobble up 6 or 7 pieces during dinner. Oh, she smacked her lips. Oh, it's delicious. Have another piece, she would say. And we wouldn't. I wouldn't touch it. I preferred the food on my plate. And I remember thinking at the time, I never said it to her, but I remember thinking at the time, you know, my mom's a little low class that she likes this bread. Can I say that? You know what I'm talking about? You know, like when we say, oh, you know, like the people that prefer the Dunkin' Donuts kind of coffee when others prefer Pete's. You know what I mean? They're just a little, you know how our minds work this way. And I remember thinking this about my mother and never saying anything. And it wasn't until years later as an adult that she told me that at that time period, she was on food stamps. She was receiving food baskets from the church, and there simply wasn't enough food on the table. She was filling her belly with a half a loaf of bread every night so that us kids could have the meat and the vegetables. She didn't like it any more than the rest of us, but she did it for us because food was that thin. Now, my mother is a very smart, very capable, well-educated woman, and yet she found herself in circumstances beyond her control that put her into that situation. And when we hear things on the news about welfare queens, which don't really exist, it's really easy to get in our minds an idea of a certain kind of person that has to, you know, avail themselves of these sorts of services. And I want to assure you, whatever stereotypes they may put out there, they're generally not true. Oftentimes, it's women with families. It's usually white women. They use food stamp services much more than women of color. My mother, at that point, was working on her bachelor's degree that she was getting from the University of California at Berkeley. And she was getting good grades. And she still found herself in a situation where she needed a little bit of assistance. So it's interesting to see how thousands of years ago, they were aware of this problem. And that the laws that Moses brought down from Mount Sinai contained within them no fewer than three times admonitions to leave your crops for the poor. And it specifies aliens, orphans, widows, and the poor in general. Three times it says that, twice in Leviticus and once in the book of Deuteronomy. You don't clean your fields completely. You leave a little behind. It gets a little more specific as you get further on where it says you leave a tenth for the poor. Because when we talk about just society, if we were to simply rely upon our kindness to take care of problems like hunger, that's not enough. There has to be an overarching organized system. Otherwise, it falls apart. And that's really hard for some people to understand. I know that there's sort of a push now as people are getting into tax evasion and more ultra super rich billionaires are renouncing their American citizenship to avoid taxes and saying, well, you know what, I'd rather not pay all those taxes and I'd rather just give to charities of my choice and let that be my helping hand. That doesn't take care of the problem. Because then you're relying upon your kindness to pick and choose who was worthy rather than saying there needs to be an overarching system so that anybody who falls through the cracks can be picked back up again. Does that make sense? Do you see the difference there? That's why the book of Leviticus doesn't say y'all need to be kind and that's enough. Just use your best judgment to try and, you know, be nice to people. It says you must not completely strip your fields. You must leave some for the alien, for the widow, for the poor, and for the orphan. And Ruth was at least three of those things. You could argue that she was an orphan because we don't know where her parents are. And her father-in-law has died. So she has rights to glean, and she ends up gleaning through the field of Boaz to get a temporary solution. And thank goodness Boaz notices her, and he starts telling the young men in the field, you have to leave her alone. She's under my protection. And he tells her, go glean over with these other women so that you have a circle around you to protect you. Being a single woman out in the fields was a little bit of a security risk. And he encourages his field hands to leave extra for her. Did you hear that in the story? He says, you know, if you are packing up the sheaves, which are the big round bundles of wheat that has not yet been harvested, if you forget one as you're transporting them, don't go back for it. Leave that for her. Just leave it for her. And as you're going by the sheaves, take out some handfuls and just kind of throw it on the ground for her to find later. He really goes to a lot of effort, which he doesn't have to do, but he does. And so between her and between Boaz helping her and Naomi advising her, they eventually find a solution. They eventually find a way for her to be able to inherit an old piece of land that belonged to her husband's or Naomi's husband's family, but she has to have a male heir first. And so Boaz marries her. She gives birth to a baby boy, and they're able to live on that land, work the land, have a house on that land, and everything works out. That's the long-term solution. That's the long-term solution. But it takes her about 4 months to get there because they go through the barley harvest and then the wheat harvest, which would have taken them from about March to June. Can you imagine what would happen if she didn't have that temporary solution between March and June? It took her 3-4 months to get back on her feet. They would have perished without food every day. So, as we talked about it with the kids today, some of them were aware, some of them were not so aware that our government does have these laws in place. They have different names. The old names used to be welfare and food stamps. Then they realized there was sort of a stigma attached to that, so they changed them. Now in California, they're called things like CalFresh or SNAP, which is an acronym for something around food, and WIC, which is Women, Infants, and Children, which is for women who are pregnant or have a child who's, I think, under the age of 2. And they have changed the system so there's no longer food stamps. You used to get little booklets, and you'd have to sign them and tear them out and pass them over to, you know, across the register. But they noticed that when everybody else is all digitized, you know, they whip out their cards and zip it through the machine, someone's sitting there signing her little food stamps and tearing them out of their booklets, people would look at them funny. You know, and there was a little stigma attached. So they changed it. They upgraded the system. And now people who have received food benefits, they get them on on cards, very much like a debit card that you can zip through the machine just like everybody else. So they're upgrading the system to try and decrease that stigma. But there is still this understanding that people who are hungry, you know, look a certain way or don't try hard enough or are just trying to mooch off the system. How many people are aware of this stigma? You especially hear it during election seasons when people are trying to argue about what they would do with the budget and where they want the money to go, and they try to justify why we shouldn't give it to the widow, to the orphan, to the sojourner, the alien, to the poor. And so I would like to introduce you to someone. I would like to introduce you to a real, honest, living person. How many people have actually known, not just seen when you do your social justice work, but actually known a close personal friend who has been on food stamps before? Good. Good. Did they look like the welfare queen that, you know, is portrayed in the media? No. No, they don't. I'd like to show you something. This is a food stamps card. It says Golden State Advantage on it. It doesn't say food stamps. That's to decrease the stigma. I couldn't find my wooden nickel. That's what they give you at farmers markets. You can cash these in and get wooden nickels because farmers markets only take cash. But there was a point in my life. There was a point in my life when I no longer had a husband, and he didn't have any money anyway. And I was raising two kids, and I was trying desperately to get back up on my feet, and I was going to graduate school because I knew that until I got my seminary degree, I would never be able to make more than $20 an hour. Never. And you cannot live in this area on $20 an hour. And there was a point where I had to apply. I had to go down to that horrible office where they grill you and ask you every kind of embarrassing question. And you got to sit in a big room with a lot of people that are looking like they're just on death's door, that don't smell too good. A lot of women nursing infants that are crying and wait to be able to get a little bit of assistance every month. But it was a temporary solution so that I could affect a long-term solution. So I just want to put that out there. And I know that this is being recorded, so there are people that will be listening to it later. That if we can break down that stigma about who people are that need a little help, what they're like, what they look like, what they act like, what kind of situations that they led to them being in the situation where they need help, it'll make a huge difference in being able to change the laws to increase the assistance that we give, because they have been whittling away at those food stamp laws ever since about the 60s. They've been whittling them away. During this election season, several states in the southern United States have just slashed food stamp benefits and just automatically, oh, 150,000 families, sorry, you're no longer eligible as of this month. And they're just gone. So those letters that you write make an enormous difference. It's not enough to just rely on our own kindness. There has to be an overarching system. There has to be some sort of organization so that people don't fall through the cracks, so that it's not left up to someone individually noticing and deciding that they are worthy of kindness to be able to give them the help that they need. Because if we rely on that, well, then we're sunk. So the books of Leviticus and Deuteronomy, people often refer to as the law. They translate the word Torah as the law. It means the instruction. And it's a map. It's a map that shows us what people understood to be the best way to get to a just society. And it is absolutely chock full of ways that you share what you have, and that if everybody in society shares a little bit of what they have and pools it, everybody can have enough. And this story of Ruth does not live in isolation. There's actually a wonderful timeline you can trace, a thread, if you will, that starts with that that story about Moses in the desert where the people were hungry. Remember, they were aliens and sojourners. They had just fled a terrible situation and found themselves out in the middle of the desert with no food, very much like Ruth, Naomi, and Orpah. And so what they did was they prayed and God rained down manna from heaven. Remember, bread from heaven to feed them, to give them a temporary solution until they could find a long-term solution, which was going to the promised land and building a society. And during that time period, Moses received these laws, which are the exact same laws that allowed Ruth, about 600 years later, to be able to glean so that she could live long enough to be able to inherit that land that was in her family that she had a right to inherit, so that she could get married and have a son. And that son ended up being the grandfather of King David. If it hadn't been for Ruth the Moabite, who was an alien and a sojourner and a widow and poor, fighting for her rights, she never would have had her son, Perez, and we would have never had King David. You see that? And King David, of course, was the ancestor of Jesus. If it hadn't been for this one woman, who went on food stamps, if you will, we never would have had Jesus. And what's interesting, the link that ties these all together, besides God again and again and again working and finding creative ways to get hungry people food in all of these stories, even to the point of Jesus sitting with 5,000 people saying, well, we only have a few loaves of bread and a couple of fishes. How are we going to make this enough so that nobody goes hungry? We see the theme again and again and again. And you know what ties them all together? This is what fascinates me. Ruth and Naomi's husband, all of this happened in the city of Bethlehem. That's where all this happened. That's where all this gleaning happened. That's where Boaz told them to protect her. King David was also born in the city of Bethlehem. And where was Jesus born again? In the city of Bethlehem. And you know what Bethlehem means? Bethlehem. The house of bread. The house of bread. Again and again, they return home and they are born out of the house of bread. And from that comes great justice around food, great justice around feeding people, and great people who are raised by those who know what it's like to go hungry and enacted laws and urged people to feed the hungry and to treat this enormous problem in society that persists today. So I urge you today, Lucinda and Taylor have gone to a lot of work to prepare letters for you and have stamps and envelopes ready to make it as easy as possible for you to express the importance of having legislation that benefits fits the hungry all across the nation and around the world. I urge you to exercise your voice. I urge you to exercise your vote so that the original instructions that we had 5,000 years ago, this map we've been given to follow, can continue today. Can I get an amen to that?